Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, somewhere they're meeting on a pinhead, calling you an angel, calling you the nicest things. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And you know, guys, I did an episode of Forward Thinking, the video show, not that long ago, where I started talking about the possibility of weather control devices. And, you know, it turns out weather's pretty complicated stuff. It has a lot of energy involved in it. But there were a lot of people who said, why are you talking about this as if this is a possible future thing? We've got one right now. And they all came up with the same example. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. I believe you're talking about a program called HARP, which is a big machine up at the North Pole that's run by reptilians.
And Cobra Commander.
Transdimensional reptilians.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Who secretly run the world. And
it causes all kinds of things like earthquakes.
Yep, uh-huh. Mind control.
Right.
Sometimes it
hurricanes.
Hurricanes. It can zap stuff right out of the sky. This is all due to the fact that conspiracy theories run rampant on the internet. No, we're going to actually talk about the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, better known as HARP, in
the
this
two
podcast.
A's.
Yes.
It's like HARP.
HARP. Yeah, so it's a little piratical in that sense. We're going to talk about what it really does and why there are all these conspiracy theories around it. Now, first of all, let's just get this out of the way. HARP is not a weather control device. It's not able to create hurricanes or guide a tornado or any of that.
That we know of or can scientifically prove to be in any way even feasible.
Yeah,
even hint at, really.
Right, yeah. Right. We don't even fully understand all the variables that go into creating the weather patterns that many people attribute to HARP. I mean, we have leading scientists who are always talking about how much we do not know and how much we're still learning about these things. So to assume that we could create and control a system as destructive and packing as much energy as a hurricane is a little
far-fetched.
Yeah, because I mean, a hurricane can have as much energy as 10,000 nuclear bombs. That's a lot of energy.
You'd think if we could reliably create hurricanes, we'd also have the power to stop them.
Yeah. Yeah, or at least steer them somewhere else, although that raises its own problems.
And maybe the interdimensional reptilians really dislike Florida.
Yeah.
It could be. Yeah. So let's talk about what HARP really is. And we'll get back to the conspiracy theory stuff toward the end and kind of talk about what was it that even got these conspiracy theories moving in the first place.
Okay. So I was wrong on lots of counts, actually. It's not even at the North Pole, is it?
No, it's in Alaska.
Yeah. But same thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's in the general region of the Arctic. It's in actually the southern central part of Alaska. It's not really close to anything else, which may in fact have lent itself somewhat to the conspiracy theories because it's not easy to get to. Or at least, it's not close to anything else.
It's near some, I looked it up on Google Maps. It's like near a hunting lodge or something.
Yeah.
That was like the closest thing I saw.
And if you were to look at this place, it would look like it's a forest of antenna. Like there are various antenna fields, some of them as large as something like 30 acres of antennas that are all spaced out exactly, where they're like 8 feet apart. It's kind of, and they're 72 feet tall. I mean, this is impressive stuff.
Yeah, it looks like a hazard you'd jump over in Mario. Like if you fell into it, you die.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, we're talking like maybe, well, really, we're talking about Super Mario.
Okay, Mario, but it's this big field of spiky metal.
Yeah. So again, it looks a little weird. So what's the deal with this thing? It's actually a program meant to study the ionosphere, which then raises the question, what the heck is the ionosphere, y'all? So the ionosphere is the very outer edge of our atmosphere. It's technically a kind of a layer within an atmosphere. Some people call it the thermosphere, and the ionosphere is part of that. So if you're going from the surface of the Earth outward, you have the troposphere, which is where all the weather happens, right? That's like, all the storms and everything that we think of, that happens in the troposphere. Then you've got the stratosphere, which we've all heard about. That's where, you know, a lot of these weather balloons that are going even higher up to study effects above the troposphere, that's where they are. It's also where you hear about things like Google's Project Loon
going
into the stratosphere.
There's a lot of different bands of air moving at different speeds there, so you can kind of catch those to get your stuff where you want it to
go. Right, right. Yeah, there are a lot of different bands, but they tend to behave in a very predictable way.
Right.
Much less, you know, the troposphere, things can get a little crazy. You know, it's party time in the troposphere. In the stratosphere, it's a little more predictable. Then you have the mesosphere, and then you have the ionosphere. So it's way out there. And
some like 80 kilometers or 50 miles above the surface at its starting point.
Yeah, yeah. So the ionosphere isn't at the exact same altitude over every point of the Earth.
So I hear the word ion in the prefix of ionosphere.
Yeah.
What does the ionosphere have to do with ions?
Well, that would be exactly where you would expect to find charged particles. That's ions. It's, you know, an ion is essentially an atom that has either lost or gained an electron. And in this case, we're talking about particles that have been zapped by the sun's energy. This is the part of our atmosphere that's absorbing some of the more harmful rays coming from the sun, like X-rays, for example. Now, as it absorbs that, the particles that absorb it get more energy and become ions. Thus, you have the ionosphere. And so you've got these magnetic fields that the Earth has, and you have these ions that are essentially trapped in that layer, this thin layer called the ionosphere. So it's an interesting part of the Earth's atmosphere. It's really useful because it helps block some of the stuff that would otherwise harm us. It also allows us to do stuff like have long-range radio communication. You know, when Marconi wanted to send a message across the Atlantic.
How are you going to do that? Because after 200 miles, the curvature of the Earth will prevent line of sight, won't it?
Right, and you would think radio waves travel in a straight line. How the heck could you get a radio wave to go, it just hit the water and that's it? No, it actually turns out that the radio wave, when directed toward the sky, would bounce off the ionosphere and reflect back down to Earth, thus allowing a transatlantic broadcast. And the first broadcast was three dots, which represents the letter S in Morse code. So that was the reason why that was possible was because the ionosphere, which at the time no one really truly understood it, and we're still learning about the ionosphere because it's so far out there that our weather balloons don't get to it, and our satellites are kind of above it for the most part. So that means that, you know, to study it directly, we'd have to find some other means of doing it. Enter HARP. That's a long introduction for this facility, but it warrants it, right? Because you have to understand that really the goal here was to learn more about radio waves, about the ionosphere, about the interaction between radio waves and the ionosphere, about what causes things like auroras, which are those beautiful lights that you could see. You know, the northern lights are what we often call them.
Right.
And in fact,
southern lights as well. Technically.
Southern lights, in fact, also happen. So this is the layer where that stuff happens, and this is why it was, you know, kind of an important way, important thing to build to study that.
But wasn't this all funded partially by the military?
Largely.
Why would the military want to know about science?
An excellent question. Why would the military be interested in funding it? Well,
let me guess. Telekinesis.
Wrong. So, you know, although we'll get into how the military was sold on this later on in this podcast, which again ties into some of the conspiracy theory stuff. But in general, really what the military was interested in was finding ways to make more effective communication systems. A couple of different reasons for this. In the 1950s, the University of Alaska started building equipment to study effects of radio waves in the ionosphere during heavy ionic activity. So, for example,
when
auroras were active. You know, Alaska's far enough up there, but yeah, auroras come because of solar flares, right? You get this crazy ionic activity, you get this beautiful light show, and one drawback for communications is that sometimes radio waves get absorbed rather than reflected back. And in the 1950s, if it meant that you couldn't have a long distance communication active in the Arctic region, that was bad news for the United States, which at the time was engaged in what we call the Cold War with the then Soviet Union. And the idea was that if you can't have reliable communication with, say, an aircraft carrying nuclear weapons that's flying toward the Soviet Union in the case of worst case scenario.
That could be bad.
That could be bad. So there was a lot of need to study this effect and figure out ways around it. So there was that. There's also the Navy that was interested in this because, as it turns out, radio waves, like our average radio waves that we tend to use for communications, are not good at penetrating seawater. Seawater is conductive. It can cause some scintillation. You get this weird changes in amplitude and frequency. And in other words, you cannot reliably use radio communication for something like a submarine that's submerged. So what do you do? Well, it turns out extremely low frequency and very low frequency radio waves, which have much longer wavelengths and very low frequencies, can penetrate seawater much more deeply than your average high-frequency radio waves can. So if you were able to build something that could, you know, transmit these waves to a submarine, then you could issue commands that without having to worry about making them surface first. There are some downsides. You wouldn't be able to have two-way communication because, as it turns out, you have to have an antenna that kind of matches the length of the wavelength we're talking about here, at least in some form of ratio, right? So ideally, if you want a resonant antenna, your antenna should be the same length as the wavelength of the radio
wave. It should be 1-to-1, right?
And so if we're talking extremely low frequency radio waves, you're talking of a wavelength of around 100,000 kilometers, which is not practical for your average submarine. Even if you were to go with a fraction, it would still be so huge you could never use a submarine. You could never have that attached to a submarine. So you might be able to use the Earth itself as part of your antenna and thus be able to eat up some of that distance that is necessary for you to be able to transmit, but you wouldn't be able to put that on a submarine so it could talk back. You could send messages to it. They couldn't talk back unless they then surfaced so that they could use regular high-frequency radio waves.
So all of this is making sense.
Yeah.
So we've got this data station and research facility that has been sponsored by the Office of Naval Research, the Air Force Research Laboratory, and DARPA. And I believe it came online originally in 1999.
Yep.
It didn't really hit full strength until something like 2007 when it got the full array.
Yeah,
going.
The full array of antennas. Yeah, they had an initial smaller array of antennas active in 99, and it took almost a decade for them to get up to what was supposed to be the full facility. So 2007 is really when they get, you know, fully operational in Death Star standards.
But it wasn't just the military that was involved. There were a lot of research facilities, right?
Yeah, in fact, lots of universities were part of this and have been part of it from the beginning. University of Alaska, of course, is a big one. They've been
kind of
very
the pioneer
involved.
Of it. Yeah,
yeah. A lot of their work was stuff that went into the initial approach. You also have Stanford, Cornell, UCLA, MIT. There are a lot of different universities that have been part of this project. And, you know, there's a lot of valuable science that's going on. Now, from the military standpoint, they want things that are applicable, right? They want things that they can use as soon as possible to make their operations more effective. The scientists, it's not that they don't want that, but they also want to do exploratory science.
Well, yeah, because we can never predict what all of the applications of exploratory science are going to be. I mean, when we learn things about the natural world that might just seem like, you know, pure information with no technological application, a lot of times 10 years down the road, it's like, oh, good thing we know that.
Oh, wait, because?
Because now we can make this thing that cleans your bathtub with the power of puppy magic.
Yeah, that's... That's almost exactly how I would have phrased that. You're absolutely right. Exploratory science, by its very nature, gives rise to developments that we could not anticipate because we're exploring, right? I mean, exploring is one of those things I'm really excited about in just about every avenue because you never know what you're going to uncover and what could potentially become not only useful, but maybe it's going to be the core of some new technology that makes, it could completely transform life as we know it.
Yeah.
So,
okay. So we've talked a little bit about some of the parts that, that HARP includes, but what exactly is on the list here?
All right, so we got let's run down a list of some of the equipment at this facility. We've talked about how there are a lot of these antenna arrays, but what is that, exactly does that mean? Well, first you got your high power, high frequency phased array radio transmitter, which has the name the Ionosphere Research Instrument, or IRI. And that's specifically used to stimulate small, well-defined volumes of the ionosphere, regions more or less directly above the HARP facility.
Yeah, it can't really range out of it. It's working sort of like a magnifying glass, the way that the array is set up, so that it's just pinpointing a very small amount of ionosphere.
Yeah.
In the simplest terms here, you're talking about aiming radio waves up at the sky to do stuff in the ionosphere.
Yeah, you're essentially exciting the particles up in the ionosphere, adding energy to them. So in many cases, you'll hear a phrase like an ionosphere heater, where they're heating the ionosphere. Now, in this case, it's not like they got a whole bunch of hair dryers and they're pointing them up at the sky.
They're exciting particles, right?
Exactly. They're using radio waves to excite particles. Now, when you're exciting particles, you're adding energy. They start moving around faster. Heat is essentially the movement of molecules. So really, it's not that it's misleading or anything. It's just kind of, I think a lot of us think of heating like you've added some sort of heating element up there, but that's not really what's going on.
And the heat is really a byproduct of everything else that they're studying.
Yeah, so the idea here is that they use this to excite certain small regions of the ionosphere directly above the HARP facility, and then run various experiments on it. Now, this does do cool things, like it creates plasma. So you get ionized gas, which is a conductive gas, right? It's got free ions running through it. You can actually run an electrical current through plasma. So, and there already are plasma bands in the ionosphere. It's not like we're introducing something that isn't already there. This is just kind of a way of studying that. So they also have a high-frequency ionosonde, also known as a chirp sounder. I love that term. And this is a type of radar. Yeah, they chirp at the sky.
No, I wasn't laughing at the chirp. I was laughing at the first word. Say that again.
Ionosonde.
It's like a French dessert.
Yeah. Monsieur, the ionosonde
à la mode. I would totally order that.
Yeah, I'm sure it'd be very ionic.
Okay, what does a chirp sounder do?
So it's a radar. It emits high-frequency radio waves over a very wide range of frequencies, and it's specifically used to examine the ionosphere, as you would expect from ionosonde.
Yeah.
And so engineers would use these to find the ideal operation frequencies for two-way radio communications in most cases. So, in other words, you might use this to see, all right, well, this particular frequency band is going to be the most effective considering the distance between the two communication points. Now, of course, HARP is using it to really study the effects that their other instruments have upon the ionosphere itself. Then you've got the extremely low frequency and very low frequency receivers. So, ELF and VLF. These are those frequencies I was talking about. They, if you're looking at the extremely low frequency range, typically we say that's 3 to 30 hertz, but in atmospheric science, it actually is 3 hertz to 3 kilohertz.
Oof, okay.
And then very low is 3 kilohertz to 30 kilohertz. And this is where we get into those crazy long wavelengths. So on the short end, if you're talking about 30 kilohertz, you're talking about around 10 kilometers for your wavelength. And on the long end, if you're going all the way down to 3 hertz, you're talking about 100,000 kilometers. So these are incredibly long radio waves. And
this is that stuff that's going to possibly do better than regular radio in
like submarines and things.
Sure.
It's also one of the other, and this is something else the military was very interested in, one of the other things it can do is penetrate the ground and potentially discover things like the location of an underground bunker, which you could probably understand the military would think, hey, that's
nifty.
Handy.
I'll take one of those.
They also, another reason why they have these receivers is because they discovered that by agitating the ionosphere, you could create these frequencies of radio waves up in the ionosphere. And so the thought was maybe you could do that instead of building those incredibly huge antenna to broadcast to a submarine. Maybe you could just use the ionosphere itself. However, that hasn't really panned out. Then you have magnetometers. or magnetometers, as I like to call them. These are not used to measure supervillains, but rather to measure magnetic fields, their strength, and their direction.
I think it's technically magnetom eaters.
Magnetom eaters? Okay. Thank you, Joe. Always keeping us on task. And then we have rheometers, which I was going to make a 1980s New Wave reference, but I'm going to back off of that. But no, that stands for the...
good job avoiding that reference
they
entirely.
They measure Rios. Yeah,
if only. No, but this is a relative ionospheric opacity meter, and that measures electromagnetic wave absorption in the ionosphere. Now, that was originally developed by researchers at the University of Alaska. This was what I was talking about when they wanted to find out the effects of aurora on radio waves.
Okay.
This is the sort of technology they were developing. Then you have a UHF diagnostic radar, which is a radar that works at ultra-high frequency radio wave frequencies, if I can be a little repetitive and redundant. And then you have, finally, optical and infrared spectrometers and cameras, which are used to observe the complex natural variations of Alaska's ionosphere, as well as to detect artificial effects produced by the IRI. So that's kind of a rundown on the general equipment that they're using over at HARP, or that they have been using at HARP, and what that stuff is supposed to do. So there you go.
Okay. So we've covered a bunch of the different ways that this equipment is being used, but I think the ones that we haven't covered so far involve space applications.
Yeah, there are a couple of different space applications. Well, one is just figuring out how to handle things like solar flares more effectively. So when a solar flare impacts the Earth, you're talking about a lot of these high energy particles interacting and energy interacting with our ionosphere, making it more aggravated, active, maybe we can say. Like, you probably have heard stories about giant solar flare storms that caused spectacular aurora, right?
There was a solar storm in the 1800s that I believe they said it caused all kinds of electrical malfunctions around the world.
Yeah, and supposedly people as far south as Cuba could see the northern lights.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Which is phenomenal. I mean, normally you can't see those if you're south of, say, Canada.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I want my laptop to continue working, but that would be really cool.
No, it'd be kind of pretty to see, but I'm actually willing to travel up there to see it rather than have it zap the entire power grid. Because, yeah, it can cause electromagnetic interference, which is a major problem in today's technology,
well,
right?
Well, we didn't have orbital electronics back then. And if we had, I'm sure it would have been a really bad scene for them. One of the other things that I think they say can sort of, like, pump the ionosphere like a solar storm would also be a high-altitude nuclear explosion.
Sure.
So if you had somebody detonate a nuclear bomb way up, high up off the surface of the Earth, it could set off this chain of reactions that could do the same thing. It could cause major
sort of
disturbance.
Like an atmospheric EMP sort
of
thing.
Yeah, lots of charged particles bouncing around that would interfere with electronics and potentially damage satellites that we depend on for all kinds of things.
So yeah, there's the potential of using HARP to at least study ways where we can mitigate that as much as possible should that ever happen.
Yeah.
There's also the idea of using, some of the experiments they've done is they've created plasma and optical emissions using this high-frequency radio beams to excite the ionosphere, which is part of the exploratory science, right? They're just kind of zapping it to see what happens, which I'm oversimplifying, so I do apologize if any of the folks out there have actively worked on these projects. But it's really to kind of learn more about these interactions and find out exactly what are the mechanisms behind it, and, you know, are there any useful applications? It's kind of a secondary consideration. We're really just learning about basics of our atmosphere here. There's also a study of the moon's surface using HARP, which I thought this was super interesting. They were using a ground-based radar and firing it at the moon, essentially. So you're shooting radar waves toward the moon.
Okay, so they're trying to blow up the moon.
They're looking at the moon. They're just looking at the moon. But these radar waves, rather, are hitting the moon, and then they would reflect off. And instead of trying to collect this information back on the Earth, where you would run into problems where there's this effect called scintillation. Scintillation doesn't mean you suddenly become incredibly interesting in conversation. It means that it actually can change the amplitude and frequency of waves so that you get corrupted data when it comes back.
Right, because it's traveling through all those layers atmosphere. Of the atmosphere.
Yeah, and so you end up having a problem there. So how do you get around that? Well, in this case, HARP was partnering with NASA. So a NASA satellite was receiving the reflected, the echoes of that radar transmission and getting the actual data of the moon's surface. So they were able to study the moon's surface from the Earth using radar and using a satellite to collect the information, which is kind of a cool thing. In fact, according to the folks at HARP, it's the first time anything like that had ever been done using ground-based technology to do a radar study of a celestial body that was then collected by a spacecraft, which, you know, the way, if you phrase it like that, it sounds like that's a plot line in a Star Trek episode. So I thought that was really cool. So that kind of covers the basic, uses of HARP so far, but there've also been a couple of others that have been mentioned as potential uses. We covered one with the nuclear, dealing with a nuclear situation where you're trying to contain particles.
Storm. Yeah, there's also, in May 2013, the National Academies, they had a workshop in Washington where they basically just talked about the future of HARP. Are we going to fund it? What use is it? You know, and so they had a report that came out on this workshop, and that listed some of the potential practical uses that the scientists attending the conference talked about. One of the ones that I thought was really interesting was about space debris.
Mm-hmm.
They imagined using something like HARP, or at least research that came out of HARP, to help deorbit old satellites and spacecraft that have become space debris. So we know the problem of space debris. Jonathan did a video on it one time. We've done a podcast. But basically, a satellite outlives its usefulness, or it stops working, or something like that.
We don't have a pull string to bring it back down to Earth. So it's basically just up there until it loses orbit.
Right. And the worry is, we don't want it crashing into anything.
Right.
And especially not in space, like currently working satellites.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, it's speculated that you could send HARP signals that might be able to trigger an ion outflow. And what that would do is increase the drag on a targeted space vehicle. So you'd have a satellite that you want to deorbit, and this ion outflow could help slow it down so that its orbit decays quicker and it burns up in the atmosphere.
Yeah, so you're essentially like creating an electromagnetic drag on this thing.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
Putting a parachute behind it, sort of.
Obviously, also hypothetical right now. It's not something that we've necessarily done.
Right, this is a speculation about possible future applications
right.
of HARP. Well, and this was last year, obviously, when its future was less certain, but it could still apply to research along the lines of HARP.
Yeah, and keep in mind, like, the reason why we're saying, why we're couching all this is because currently it looks like HARP is going to be completely defunded in the near future. It already shut down once in the summer of 2013. Actually, toward the end of May 2013, and it was only reported on by around July of 2013 that HARP had shut down. There was that the facility was empty. All the generators had been turned off.
Like the website was down because no one could pay the University of Alaska to keep it up.
Yeah, which that's pretty serious right there. I mean,
yeah.
I think the first website I ever made is still up somewhere on the internet. But,
I think GeoCities finally took mine down.
Oh yeah, yeah. So yeah, it's
You let me guess, Genesis MIDI's.
I'm not gonna.
Is that your website?
I'm not gonna dignify that with a response. At any rate,
he means
so
yes.
So at any rate, it shut down. The explanation was that it was actually changing hands. That a different group was coming in to take over the facility, and it came back online briefly anyway. But it's already. This is the beginning of 2014 when we're recording this podcast. And at the moment, it sounds like once the Department of Defense is done with a series of final experiments, this facility may shut down unless some other group comes in and takes it over, because it's really expensive to run.
Yeah. I mean, I have a vague feeling that someone's going to be interested in keeping this thing going.
Like Cobra Commander.
Exactly. Yeah. Or the interdimensional
Reptilians.
Reptilians, yeah.
Okay, so I already have a good theory as to why the interdimensional reptilians are a no-go in terms of explaining this, but we can get into
by not existing?
Into the conspiracy theories now, I think, right?
Yeah, definitely.
But here's my thing on the reptilians.
Okay.
We all know that they live in underground chambers, right?
Right.
And secretly rule the world from these vast underground caverns. What is one of the things that HARP can do? Help us detect underground bunkers. The reptilians don't want to have their bunkers discovered.
If they're the ones controlling it, then they can just point it at all the places where the bunkers aren't.
Okay,
first of all, none of us believe about these reptilians. Let's make that clear.
Yeah.
We're all being very facetious.
Let's discuss all of the bizarre stuff we've seen people saying about HARP on the internet.
Well, let's be fair. Okay, so there are a lot of conspiracy theories about HARP.
Fringe theories, please. Thank you.
Conspiracy theories about HARP on the fringe. And these fringe theories are there's a seed there. I can understand why the seed had been planted and grown into a beautiful fringe flower in some people's minds. So if you look back at the history of HARP, there was a fellow physicist by the name Bernard Eastland who patented several different he filed for several patents and got patents for these ideas that he had about exciting the ionosphere. So he was looking at using this big natural gas deposit that had been found in Alaska as means to fuel an ionosphere heater. So the same sort of technology we're talking about to study the effects on the ionosphere. But he also hypothesized about some other things that this device might possibly do. And these are things that have taken hold in the minds of people who really subscribe to these fringe theories. So here are two, and these are direct quotes from the one of the patents. One was, weather modification is possible by, for example, altering upper atmosphere wind patterns or altering solar absorption patterns by constructing one or more plumes of atmospheric particles which will act as a lens or focusing device. Another is, and again I quote, as alluded to earlier, missile or aircraft destruction, deflection, or confusion could result, particularly when relativistic particles are employed. Also, large regions of the atmosphere could be lifted to an unexpectedly high altitude so that missiles encounter unexpected and unplanned drag forces with resultant destruction or deflection of same.
I would like to put in at this juncture that when the government approves a patent, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're stamping it with something that just says science fact.
Yeah.
This is all theorization.
Yeah, yeah. It was completely hypothetical. And furthermore, there was no need to actually prove that it works in order to get a patent.
Yeah, I mean, this is something tons of people take advantage of. You have an idea and you patent it. That doesn't mean it works.
Right,
right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. So, and in fact, when the Department of Defense decided to do a feasibility study based on these ideas, they looked at a bunch of different companies to, you know, contract out and try and build stuff to do this. And one of those companies had a consultant named Dennis Papadopoulos. And Papadopoulos ended up looking at these projected ideas of Eastland's and said, yeah, that would not work. I mean, it wouldn't work even if you had this placed at an ideal location, which the area in Alaska was not ideal for these particular applications like weather modification and destroying a missile. He said even if it were in the best position on the planet, it still wouldn't work. However, important science could be done using this kind of technology. So if we can just figure out a way to sell it to the military, then we can get the money to build it, and then we can actually do research. And his point was saying that radio research had really taken a back seat for a really long time, since the 1950s, really. And that in order to get back to doing, you know, groundbreaking research, you know, you had to figure out how you're going to fund it. And he didn't want to create false reasons, right? He didn't want to give them a false sense of this is what this device can possibly do.
Of course not. But I mean, but the military and the government, especially a couple decades ago, had a great deal of money to throw at scientific pursuits like this.
Yeah.
And just, you know, angling it so that they would pick up on that.
Yeah. And in this case, the way he angled it was rather than talk about weather modification and missiles being destroyed, he talked more about the extremely low frequency and very low frequency bands and the possible applications that could be used. And that's what got the ball rolling. And so, There's another interesting conspiracy theory about HARP besides weather modification. So the weather modification thing doesn't really pan out. It's just there's no way that HARP could really do it. They can't direct any sort of energy to lens the atmosphere. Plus, the weather happens in the troposphere, and the ionosphere is really far away from the troposphere.
One thing I do want to clarify, I think what you're saying is that it's not just that, hey, this isn't what they're trying to do. It's that even if they wanted to, they probably couldn't control the weather.
I guess they might be able to change a little bit of parts of the atmosphere directly above their own research facility, but I'm not sure if that would.
I think the most they could do is maybe change how much,
like how much solar radiation,
how much solar radiation gets in, so that because you know weather patterns are largely affected by changes in heat. That's the main thing that changes these weather patterns, right? So in theory, if you were able to change the amount of energy coming into the Earth, you would therefore change the weather, but it would not be in a necessarily predictable or controllable way. So even if that was the purpose of HARP, it'd be like, you know, just turning on a switch and having no idea what the effect was going to be. It's not like you could have any sort of controlled experience, even if that was what you had intended.
Well, interdimensional reptilians are chaotic evil, so they don't really care.
How would you know? You're not chaotic evil, according to the test we all took. I'm lawful good, as it turns out, and a liar.
Yeah, I'll believe that.
You haven't read my alignment readout. It's hilarious. So another conspiracy theory was that HARP could possibly create earthquakes. We mentioned that at the top of the show, right? That it could somehow create earthquakes. There are two ways I have heard about this happening, and both of them are not really feasible. Now, one is kind of interesting in that some scientists say that before an earthquake happens, you might be able to detect ELF or VLF frequencies because the pressures in the ground are compressing minerals that will give off these frequencies just naturally through that compression. So if you had a detector somewhere nearby, you could, in theory, detect those variations and thus predict when an earthquake is going to happen.
So thereby, by a like piezoelectric kind of effect, maybe if you put those frequencies into those minerals, you could trigger an earthquake.
That's one of the hypotheses, which I hesitate to even call it that. It is not necessarily realistic. But that's not the chief one about how people thought HARP was somehow creating earthquakes. Here's what they were really thinking, and this one is what I don't know. It just, to me, it seems completely unfeasible. So imagine that you are lifting part of the atmosphere up, like you're actually raising up the ionosphere, and then you let it slam down, and somehow the pressure of it slamming back down is what induces an earthquake to happen. This theory does not seem to explain what would happen to the rest of us on the surface of the ground if this was actually powerful enough for it to induce an earthquake, nor does it explain the fact that any energy it would exert coming down would be equivalent to the amount of energy used to raise it up, right? That's basic physics. If I raise a one kilogram mass to a certain distance off the ground and drop it, you know, it's not like it's going to exert more energy than it costs to raise it up that high. It's going to be exactly the same. That's physics.
So what you're talking about is this facility doing this would have to be able to create enough energy to essentially shake the ground.
Exactly.
Itself.
Right. You wouldn't need to shoot it up at the atmosphere. You'd have essentially some sort of earthquake button right there at your disposal. And the energy that HARP is putting forth is, I think, something like 3.6 megawatts, which, don't get me wrong, that's
a lot
of energy.
Sure.
But it's not enough to create an earthquake.
No.
So that was another one.
Also, a thing to keep in mind when we're talking about all of these conspiracy theories and HARP is that so radiation from the sun is hitting the ionosphere all the time, continually, and a lot more than HARP is capable of producing.
Right.
Like orders of hundreds of thousands.
We're talking like, you know, I mean, the sun's energy is what makes the ionosphere happen in the first place, right?
Yeah.
And HARP is only able to excite a relatively teeny tiny region of that ionosphere, like a sliver of it. So, you know, the fact that the sun is doing this naturally all the time is another kind of mark against HARP doing anything that would affect, you know, things on a global scale.
Oh, right. Or even on a weaponized kind of scale. And furthermore, I mean, some of these theories are talking about moving sections of the ionosphere. And even if HAARP could move a section of the ionosphere that was not directly above itself, and I don't think it wants to cause itself to experience an earthquake, the ionosphere undulates all the time. It expands and contracts based on the degree of the Earth's tilt and whether it's nighttime or daytime.
Yeah.
I mean, this happens constantly.
Right, right. So it's not like, yeah. I think a lot of the theories, the fringe theories, are based on just misunderstandings of science. I mean, it's just you don't have a full understanding of what's going on. And so you're oversimplifying in your mind how things work. And thus, when you do that, then suddenly everything becomes possible, right? If you oversimplify everything and don't acknowledge how complex and difficult some of these problems really would be to do for realsies, then obviously this secret facility in Alaska, which, by the way, wasn't really secret, although it was very much restricted because they were doing lots of scientific study that didn't, you know, they didn't need people butting in on all the time.
Sure.
Well, I read at least one account of some amateur ham radio enthusiast who just went on up to the facility and walked around. And
The policy was supposed to be it's a closed-door facility that very rarely was open to the public. It was only open to the public
open
a couple times.
Once every couple of years.
And then, of course, they would let, you know, college students could go up there and work on it because they were parts of research programs. It's, you know, you don't typically... maybe I'm basing this off bias, but the college students I remember are not necessarily the ones you invite into your super secret headquarters for world domination and weather control.
They're all part of the theory, and all the other research about the ionosphere is bad leader material.
They're only allowed
misdirect.
In the ping pong room. Yeah. They're not allowed to see the real facility.
Yeah, they just give them beer to distract them.
It just gives the facility credibility as a research
College students tend to be reptilian collaborators.
Okay, enough with the reptiles. Jeez. All right, so anyway, you read one comment off one article, and suddenly it all
science
goes...
Science fact.
No, it's true. I'm sorry, folks. This came from the fact that I was reading an article from an Alaska publication about HAARP, and one of the comments was like, yeah, reptilians are behind this.
Yeah. And of course, like I said, when I did the episode about weather control, we got a lot of comments about the HAARP facility. And again, most of it's just misunderstandings, you know, things that, you know, you're reading a report of a report of a report of a conspiracy theory. You know, they've been pervasive, and they certainly have a level of like they're enticing, right? You know, the idea of some sort of secret organization or secret part of our government being in control of these massive powers. There's a weird attraction to that idea.
Well, even if you did think HAARP was something that was a secret government plot to control the weather, earthquakes, tsunamis, whatever, you need worry no longer.
Yeah, because it's pretty much done. Yeah.
Look,
like
look
we said.
Elsewhere for your secret government facility
right,
that is doing
right.
those things.
Yeah.
So what's the status on the facility?
I mean, any day now it could close for good. It's running through those last few experiments, and as of the recording of this podcast, there have been no plans to hand over the facility. Like there's not been an organization that stepped forward and said, we will fund this. I mean, it costs millions of dollars to run this facility because it takes a lot of power to actually do these experiments. It's not a cheap endeavor. So if some research facilities or private company comes in to take over, then we could see it continue in action. Otherwise, it may just become an abandoned, forgotten site. And I mean, it was abandoned for a little while in 2013. It might become permanently so in 2014. We'll have to wait and see. So anyway, that kind of wraps up this discussion about HAARP. We just wanted to kind of take a closer look at it and demystify it for everybody.
Yeah, and send out our good mojo into the universe, possibly by earthquake or reptilian, whatever, you know, to hopefully someone will pick this thing back up.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the good feelings I do have is that I think there is a bright future for more radio research. I mean, it's the thing, it's the kind of research we don't often think about.
Yeah.
But that really does yield important discoveries that figure into the kinds of technologies we use every day.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, here's hoping that this exploratory science continues in some form or another. And guys, if you have been enjoying our show and you haven't visited fwthinking.com, go and do that. Go do the thing I just said. Go visit fwthinking.com. And the reason why I say that is because that's where we have videos, we've got podcasts, we've got blog posts, we have other material that relates to the stuff we talk about. It's all about science and technology in the future, and it's really exciting stuff. Well, you should go check it out. And remember, you can interact with us on social networks, because we are present on Facebook, on Twitter, and Google Plus with FW Thinking. Come be part of the conversation. We actually had a suggestion recently pop up on the Facebook page that I'll be revealing to the other podcasters shortly as after we go off the air, because it's kind of cool. So be one of those, you know, let us know what you want to hear, because that's really what we're here to talk about. Have an interesting conversation about the future. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.